Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. I am Carrie Weber, along with Father Matt Malone and Kevin Clark, and we soon will be joined by Michael O'Loughlin, our national correspondent. And first, we're going to talk a little bit about this article on americamagazine.org. Nancy Pelosi says pro-life Americans are welcome in the Democratic Party. This seems like possibly more in word than in reality sometimes, though.
Well, this was news to a number of pro-life activists, so it was well worth publishing a piece about it. This is a question that America Magazine has been asking for years, and we actually
literally asked it.
When we interviewed Vice President Biden before the papal visit in, when was that, 2014, 2015? I don't remember exactly.
The years run away like wild horses.
2015.
When Pope Francis came to the U.S., yeah. We asked him, is there room for pro-life people in the Democratic Party? And he said, yes, absolutely yes. But not everybody agrees with Vice President Biden. And we saw there was a bit of a flare-up over the last month within the Democratic Party about whether you can be pro-life and you can be a faithful Democrat. Some say yes, some say no. Nancy Pelosi intervened and said, actually, she is pro-choice, but pro-life Americans are welcome in the Democratic Party. And she pointed to actually to members of her family. She herself is a Catholic, and the members of her family are Catholics. And she said most of them are pro-life. And she said, and I'm not going to kick them out of the Democratic Party because of that.
No, she also said, quote, can somebody get the nomination? I don't think so.
Right.
So you can join the party, you just can't run for anything.
Or speak at any party conventions.
And I think that is the real problem here,
yeah.
Because the truth of the matter is there are a lot of districts in this country that where a pro-life Democrat would be competitive.
Would actually do well.
Right.
Yeah.
And could very well defeat the Republican, you know, in these purple swing districts.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they can't get through a primary.
Right.
They can't get past the first post. And so it she's probably right. You know, could
yeah.
a pro-life person win the nomination? Probably not. Could they win a primary? No. But could they win a general election in, you know, maybe two dozen districts in the South and the West? Perhaps.
Right.
And that's the question that they really need to ask themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they want to cut off their nose despite their face here electorally.
Yeah.
And it seems like the Democratic Party wants to have it all. They want to have pro-life Democrats support their candidates without creating a space for pro-life Democrats to articulate in a coherent manner their position within the party. Minority Leader Pelosi says, there's National Abortion Rights Action League waiting to pounce anytime there's any sort of wobbling on a pro-choice position by a candidate. So now you have the specter of this poor guy from Omaha, did not understand that he was inviting this battle when he invited Bernie Sanders to come and support
him.
Yeah,
let our listeners know about that story. They may not know.
Well, is forgetting his first name, but his last name is Mello.
Heath
Mello. Thank you. He's running for mayor of Omaha, Nebraska. And this was supposed to be a unity tour that Bernie Sanders was participating in. And by the time Bernie left, it had become the disunity tour. Maybe it was Spinal Tap's earlier tour. I don't know. But poor Heath was put in position to having to walk back his previously... someone in the pro-life community would say he wasn't a very strong pro-life candidate. He had voted for a number of moderate attempts to create space for women to reconsider their choices when they're getting abortions, and that was enough to get the National Abortion Rights Action League in his grill, as it were, and up in Bernie Sanders' grill, and they sort of insisted on a statement that defines Democratic Party members to being people who accept the pro-choice position without question. And Mr. Mello, by the time the week was over, sort of seemed to be trying to say that, tried to formulate the classic Mario Cuomo, I'm pro-life personally, but I'm not going to be that in terms of any of the public policy I pursue, which is a deeply frustrating thing for pro-life Democrats to hear. Because once again, we've circled back to the point where there really is no space for pro-life Democrats to articulate a position that makes any sense in terms of public policy.
And the new chair of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, weighed into this debate.
In two different directions within 2 days,
right.
That creating more confusion. First, he seemed to suggest that it's okay for someone like Keith Mello to run as a Democrat, that he would support him. And then after the Narwhal pro-choice America jumped on him, he completely backtracked and basically said that only candidates who completely accepted a pro-choice platform would be acceptable and that would get the support from the party. That in turn provoked yet another backlash from people like Pelosi, and even Chuck Schumer felt obliged to weigh in to say, yes, you can be pro-life and be a Democrat.
And it seems to me that this is a worthwhile debate, and it's a debate that Democratic Party should have, just like I think in the Republican Party, they need to ask themselves about the litmus test on guns.
Yeah.
And
to have a debate, you have to have someone able to articulate their position.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. They're not allowed to really articulate their position.
Indeed, you do. The piece is Nancy Pelosi says pro-life Americans are welcome in the Democratic Party. You can find it at americamagazine.org. And its author, our national correspondent, Michael O'Loughlin, joins us now in the studio. Nice to see you, Mike.
Yeah, good to see you, too. It's nice to be here in New York with
you. So what did you make of this story when you were reporting it? Now that we've already told everybody what to think.
Yeah, it was a lot of back and forth, right? Like Kevin mentioned, it was kind of, they are welcome. We're going to campaign for this sort of pro-life Democrat who lost the election yesterday.
Is that right?
An update to the story.
That.
Yeah, he fell short about 6 or 7 points. Kind of set off this kind of wavering back and forth that I found interesting. You had some elected Democrats, pro-choice Democrats in more moderate districts or states who said, yeah, I'm pro-choice, but we have to let these people in because they know that their seats are in jeopardy if they don't kind of cast a bigger net. So people like Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri, for example, she really went out of her way to say, no, Tom Perez is wrong. We need these people in our party.
Did you think that Mello's loss had anything to do with this debate happening just before the election?
I have not weighed into the research.
I can't imagine
that
it helped too much to have this be the main thing people were thinking about when they went into vote instead of whatever local issues he was trying to push.
Yeah,
he became a national story.
Do you have a sense that there might be something breaking loose within the party, within the national party on this issue?
Well, we never heard the party say things like they did during the last election, that basically that they were going to go after the Hyde Amendment and made that a platform.
The Hyde Amendment, which prohibits
federal
funds
money
from going
to
abortion providers.
Yeah, so they made that part of their platform. And then you had some very odd commentary from the candidate about how religions need to adapt to this idea of, abortion being morally acceptable. Something seems to be changing in terms of whether or not it's justified within the party. There is a pro-choice camp that really feels that they are in a position to dictate these kinds of issues for the rest of the party, and by extension, the average rank-and-file Democrats across the country, many of whom do not come from, a sort of a liberal bastion like New York or...
Yeah, this is why I ask the question, because it speaks to the topic that we were talking about at the top of the hour, which is this gap between the elites and the governors and the governed. And, the folks that the Democratic Party needs to appeal to in order to win... Mm-hmm. Are folks who are a bit more sympathetic to the pro-life message. And so I wonder whether this debate is, when Claire McCaskill says this and Nancy Pelosi says this, are they actually signaling over and above the kind of activist elite that operates the Democratic Party to those folks, some of those swing voters in swing states?
I think they're signaling to the elite as well that this conversation is not closed. I don't know if they're going to. What I think will be interesting is what things what Pelosi says, what Schumer says, what McCaskill says. How is that going to go down in these lobby offices in Washington and New York? Are they going to say, hey, you know what, we really do need to make room for pro-life Democrats, or we need to have this conversation, or are they going to double down on their offensive on this?
Right.
Yeah, well, there's been more. I feel like the conversation kind of on the ground among activists has become less and less charitable, honestly. If you look at social media, if you look at Twitter and things like that, people responding to this topic are more on, sometimes on both sides,
more,
you know,
brittle,
more about shutting somebody down, and in a way that just is really discouraging when I read it, you know. It just,
well, it ties in with the Women's March, where pro-life feminists had a very hard time, quite literally, finding space to even march, because there were so many groups who were saying they shouldn't be allowed to participate in this.
Yeah, it seems like conversation around this issue shuts you out from conversations around a lot of other important issues these days. So if you talk about being pro-life in the traditional sense regarding abortion, but also feel like you're pro-life around refugees or gun control or any of these other things, it makes it really hard to be a part of those other conversations lately, I think, because there's a lot of people who feel very strongly about this one issue and use this as a way to tell you, all right, your opinion on these other matters doesn't count. And this isn't everybody. It's not, you know, I don't want to paint with a hugely broad brush, but I don't know. It's something that I've found just people less and less willing to really kind of hear each other out on and allow someone to be a part of a larger conversation. I don't know. Do you disagree?
I don't know. Mike, do you pick up on anything like that?
Something Nancy Pelosi said in that article, which I thought was interesting, was she said the abortion issue in the Democratic Party was beginning to fade, that it wasn't controversial anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that this shows that that's not the case, right? So maybe if you surround yourself with people who it's not an issue for because the other side has been shut down, you get the impression that the issue has faded and it's not important. But like you said, there is this bigger dialogue going on, hopefully going on if people aren't clashing, that shows it's still really fraught with emotions on both sides.
I mean, and of course, the Democratic Party and its leadership are not the only folks who are trying to maintain their balance in the, you know, while standing amid the shifting sands of Trumpian politics. You reported, Mike, last week on the executive orders on religious liberty and health care that the president signed at the White House in the presence of some Catholic leaders, and how this kind of showcased two styles of U.S. Catholicism.
Yeah, this occurred to me as I was covering the story last week. Basically, what happened was the president held an event at the White House marking the National Day of Prayer. He invited a cross-section of religious leaders from around the country to join him. Representing Catholics were Cardinal Donald Wuerl of Washington and Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of Houston, who's also the president of the Bishops' Conference. And the president gave a short speech in which he said people of faith had been bullied in the United States and that he wanted to bring this to an end. And to do that, he signed an executive order which did two things. It promised a sort of end to the Johnson Amendment, which is a 1950s era rule that prohibits churches from engaging in partisan politics. That if they endorse candidates, smear other candidates, they could risk losing their tax-exempt status. It's a rule that really hasn't been enforced by the IRS in decades anyway, and the president can't just get rid of it on his own. He would need Congress to do that. So in that sense, it wasn't a big deal. Conservatives were hoping for something much more broad that would give them freedom to cite religious objections when serving gay and lesbian people at businesses, for example, and they didn't get that. But the second half of the executive order, which was related more to Catholic issues, was the president has directed the Department of Health and Human Services to craft guidelines that would free Catholic healthcare entities and other Catholic organizations from needing to comply with the contraception mandate. This is part of the Affordable Care Act that says insurance needs to cover contraception. The Little Sisters of the Poor were on hand for the signing of the executive order. This is a religious order that has fought for years with the Obama administration over this this mandate, and the president promised relief from that. So that was some people who had supported the Little Sisters were excited about this, right? But others said this doesn't actually do anything. Right. The Supreme Court had already ordered a solution to this. We were going to get relief for the Little Sisters anyway. This is kind of just a photo op.
And we should clarify, Michael, by mandate at that level, because you had a religious exemption for clearly Catholic organizations. I think it extended to schools. It started to get, when you started to spread out into like healthcare, some of the less directly connected church institutions, that's where the issue was becoming a problem. I think Little Sisters of the Poor had a nursing home. Is that what the...
Yeah, I mean, it's an order that runs nursing homes for poor elderly people.
So they weren't mandated to provide contraception. They were mandated to write a letter saying that they didn't want to participate in providing contraception and to be exempt from that, which would have been fine under the Obama administration's existing HHS guidelines. Mm-hmm. They refused to do that as well because they considered that being
part of the process.
Yeah. Right.
So that got me thinking, actually, about this signing ceremony, this participation by Catholic leaders standing behind the president as he signed this executive order. I was thinking about when the Affordable Care Act was signed into law 7 years ago. There was another Catholic sister who was involved in that process, Sister Carol Keehan, who's head of the Catholic Health Association. And she got a little bruised throughout that process. There was a lot of...
There are still people furious with her about that.
There are. There was a lot of controversy about that bill, as we know. Catholic bishops came out against it because they believed that it was going to be using federal money for abortion, that it would... go against the church's belief on contraception. But she came out and said, what can we do to get more people insurance? And she backed the bill. The president ultimately said that Sister Keehan's backing the bill was what allowed it to pass because Catholic health care is so important and so big in this country.
There are a number of wavering pro-life Democrats, now sort of the white buffalo of the Democratic Party, but there were some, about 30 of them back then.
That
her cover allowed them to vote for the bill.
Mm-hmm. So it got me thinking, you know, there's two styles here. One is kind of being asking the government to leave the church alone so it can do its great charity work. And the other one is saying, let's get involved in the process. It's going to be messy and we're going to get hurt during it, but ultimately something good will come of it. Something better than if we didn't get involved will come out of the process. So I think it's just something to think about, how the church acts in the public square during the rest of the Trump administration.
And you made the point, Michael, of connecting that to what Pope Francis has been saying.
Exactly. Way back in 2013, Pope Francis wrote a document in which he said he really wanted the church to kind of get out of its own head, be out in the streets. It might be bruised and dirty, but he'd rather have that than a church that's kind of inward focused.
We are talking this week with our national correspondent, Michael O'Loughlin. We're talking politics, we're talking pro-life, we're talking popes, and I imagine a lot of the...
Only words with
just,
P at the beginning.
One pope at the moment. I imagine this kind of intersection of all these topics will be of increasing importance, as we mentioned at the top of the show, when Pope Francis and President Trump meet in the coming weeks.
Yeah, so before the break, we were talking about this White House prayer ceremony, right? And there was some news there. The president revealed that during his first foreign trip as president, he would be stopping in Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the Vatican to see the Pope.
Now he's on his way to the G7 summit.
Yep, he'll be in Sicily after his meeting with the Pope. He'll be down for the G7
that's
summit.
That's a lot of places to go in a very short... It'd be interesting to see how he holds up under the travel pressures.
Yeah, I guess
there.
It's a later start for overseas travel for Trump than it has been for previous presidents, but he'll be
he had a lot to do.
And
here.
Also, does it make... break with tradition here, which we have to mention because America's published by the Jesuits of Canada and the United States. Traditionally, the first visit outside of the country is to Canada,
right,
the president.
Wow.
But I don't know how we're going to complain about this because he's going to the Vatican. So
right. So the much speculated about meeting will take place May 24th at the Vatican at 8:30 Rome time. During the visit, the president will meet with the Pope and the Secretary of State. And so you mentioned at the top of the hour this video we made that's on the American Magazine website, kind of chronicling the history of the relationship between the president and the Pope.
And if you're looking for it, Trump and Francis, A History in Tweets.
That's right. Now, the two have never met, but they have talked about and at each other through the media and social media in particular. And I broke down their relationship into pre-campaign, campaign, and then the President Trump era. Interestingly, when the Pope was elected in 2013, Donald Trump was active on Twitter already, and he sent a congratulatory message to Catholics, congratulating Catholics on their new Pope. And he said he thought he was going to like this Pope because he seemed really humble, just like himself. So it was kind of a funny way to congratulate the new Pope. Right. But then that quickly kind of soured. Well, because
he's great at being, he's the best at being humble.
It's true.
So.
The world's
an old Jesuit joke.
Humble.
I'm sorry.
And then you remember when Pope Francis paid for his hotel room in Rome?
Always.
Donald Trump didn't like that. He tweeted out that it didn't seem Pope-like. Those were his words.
He was also not staying at a Trump hotel.
He was not. He was not.
It doesn't seem Pope-like. That's it.
But then the relationship...
Unpopish.
Unpopish. It seemed to recover because someone asked Donald Trump who his dream contestant would be for a Celebrity Apprentice, which he was still hosting at the time. And Trump replied that it would be the Pope. So he really wanted the Pope on his show, even though this un-Pope-like behavior at the hotel room.
I think NBC reached out.
Checking out of the hotel room. Checking out of your hotel room, un-Pope-like. Being on reality TV, very Pope-like.
The Pope
apparently
did
it's
not
presidential.
Oh, the Pope didn't. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, just so you know, don't go searching for that. So then during the campaign, Donald Trump transitions from reality TV to politics. And one of his big campaign promises is to build this wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Build the wall, right? So Pope Francis, back in February of 2016, he goes to visit Mexico. And, you know, the Pope has talked for years and years, well before Trump was even on the horizon, about the need for wealthy countries to welcome migrants and refugees. And before the Pope got to Mexico, Trump said that he was a very political person, that he didn't understand the United States, and accused him of being a pawn for the Mexican government. So this kind of set off this little battle between Trump and the Pope. So on the way home from Mexico, the Pope joked that maybe he was a pawn. He didn't know, and he didn't seem to care.
That seems Pope-like.
And he was asked by a reporter what he thought of then-candidate Trump's proposal to build this wall. And the Pope said that any politicians who seek to build walls and not bridges, they're not Christian. Trump did not take this criticism well. He called the Pope disgraceful, which then led the Vatican to say that the Pope was speaking generally and not about Trump specifically. So then later that night on CNN, Trump
just used the specific words that the candidate had just
said. Yeah, he did say any. So he would be included in that group of one politician who's doing this.
There are other walls being built around the world,
well,
but the Pope does know what's happening in the United States, we're told. Trump said on CNN that he forgave the Pope. I don't know if the Pope asked for forgiveness, but there you go. And then days before the election, there's an article on our website that talks about this speech the Pope gave to activists in which he urged people around the world not to give in to a politics of fear, which some of people in the Vatican said was a message for the United States as well as other people.
Then that was just a few days, like two or three days before
Before the election.
Yeah.
Trump wins the election. And Pope Francis sends him a congratulatory telegram, which is custom.
I love that the Vatican uses telegrams, by the way.
Still uses telegrams.
I would love to get a Vatican telegram.
Right. They would normally send doves, but the Atlantic is
this
too,
one came through the Prussian consulate.
In the telegram, he urges President Trump to remember the poor and the outcast. And then we fast forward a little bit. Pope Francis writes a letter back in February to activists meeting in California, urging them to fight to protect the planet and stand up for migrants. Again, this is kind of a message aimed at Americans who are living through a certain political climate, right? One of the Pope's top advisors cites Trump specifically and says that the president's denial of climate change presents challenges for humanity.
Which in Vatican speak is like a thrashing.
That's
pretty harsh, yeah.
Pretty direct. To name a leader and call him out like that is pretty unusual. And then we're now still waiting to hear who Trump will name as his ambassador to the Vatican. This could kind of give us clues into how Trump sees his relationship with the Holy See, how he might work with the Vatican on common issues. We're not sure who that is yet. And then just in the last couple of weeks, the Pope says he's willing to meet Trump as he is any head of state. And as I said last week, Trump says that he will indeed be meeting the Pope. So I've been thinking about, what is this meeting possibly going to be like?
Yeah.
You have this kind of fraught history between the two guys, even though they've never met.
Do they have a very set time that every leader gets with the Pope, or does certain leaders get more?
That's a good question.
If I'm president of the Grand Duchy of Fenwick, do I get like 5 minutes with the Pope?
Oh, you mean a set duration?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I know that sometimes they go over. I know when
they must have it scheduled out at some point.
I'm sure they. Yeah, they must.
Well, they said something about 30 minutes. We'll always give any head of state who asks for it 30 minutes with the Pope. But I would imagine.
I just met with an ambassador to the Holy See yesterday who said that he had gone in and he was scheduled for 10 minutes and stayed for 40. So I think it's largely
if the conversation goes well, I guess you just keep chatting.
I know when the Pope was in Washington, his meeting with President Obama went over the scheduled time. But that was a different sort of thing. That was the president receiving the Pope. So I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Now, there was a lot of confusion about that meeting, too, though. We should say that it wasn't clear if President Trump was planning to meet with the Pope for the longest time. You know, normally these things take place, the invitations or the requests come weeks and weeks earlier.
It's true. And the Vatican kept saying that they hadn't received the request.
Hadn't received
so
a request.
We thought for a while it might not happen.
Well, given the history that you just recited, you know, they probably had to think through exactly how they wanted to do it, whether they wanted to do it, what the optics of it would be, and how it would play in American politics and so forth. One of the questions that I had, Mike, and you've done really good reporting on this, is that, American Catholics, we tend to think that everything that the Pope says and does is about us and what's happening in the U.S., but you think that this really is an indirect conversation that's been happening between them over the last year.
I mean,
sometimes very direct, obviously, when they incite each other. But
there is a little bit of debate about when is the Pope talking about the United States and when is he talking broadly. And I think the answer can be both. I think he, his aides have said that he is aware of what's happening in the United States. It would be kind of malfeasance if he didn't. So yes, we're not the only country dealing with a border issue, dealing or not dealing with a refugee migrant issue, but we are one of the countries that the Pope has in mind when he makes these statements. So it's important not to either read too much into what the Pope's saying and saying he's always talking about Trump, which is what some of Trump's critics do. On the other hand, it's important not to dismiss what the Pope's saying, which I think is what some of critics of the Pope do.
Mm-hmm. And so what should we be looking for as they go into this meeting together?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the Pope will raise some of the issues he's raised throughout his papacy, including the migrant issue, the refugee issue, climate change. He wrote a whole encyclical on protecting the environment, so it would be odd if that didn't come up. What I'm curious about is where the Trump administration and the Vatican might work together on issues. And something happened this week that kind of went off the radar, but the head of the Knights of Columbus met with Vice President Mike Pence at the White House, and I'm sure they were talking about this meeting. Knights of Columbus are hugely influential, and one of the items that they've been concerned with in recent years is Christian persecution in the Middle East. This has been a priority for the Knights of Columbus. It's been a priority for Pope Francis, and it's actually something that Trump himself seems somewhat sympathetic to, maybe. At least that's what his Christian supporters say. So maybe there's some room there for the administration and the Vatican to see where they can work together to help the plight of Christians experiencing persecution in the Middle East.
That would be good.
It would be positive.
Yeah, I think it is.
When you've got like less than 40 minutes or an hour, do you just skip the small talk? I guess, does Trump sit down and say, let's go to Syria. Let's bang this out. What's your opinion on the Syrian crisis?
They'll exchange gifts, so that'll take some time.
Yeah.
There'll be interpreters, obviously. I don't think President Trump speaks
now,
Italian.
Now, the Pope tends to give copies of Laudato Si and his other statements to visiting heads of state, so that would probably be a good thing for the President Trump to thumb through on the way home.
Yeah, it'll be the climate thing.
Maybe the president will give the Pope the art of the deal, or
that would be fascinating.
Right. I mean, I think what's interesting, I was asked the other day whether the Pope might be intimidated in meeting with the president of the United States or this particular president of the United States. And I said, I don't think so. The man's dealt with a junta. When he was Archbishop,
those guys were
in Argentina, right? Yeah. They were intimidating, and he didn't seem to be intimidated by them. But also, it's this notion that we always come back to in politics whenever the Vatican somehow, even indirectly, inserts itself in the political discourse, that somehow the Vatican and the Pope are in some way naive and out of touch and misinformed. And, you know, you can say a lot about them. You can even say that they're wrong, but I don't think you can really say that they're naive. They've been dealing with politicians for quite a long time.
Pope Francis seems not easily intimidated by anyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you said in that particular example. And Mike, I think it'll be interesting to see how the tweets follow up to this meeting as well.
So the Pope tweets a lot about the migrant crisis. And something interesting is Trump has been talking about this subject a lot, and the Pope inevitably will tweet a day or two later about it. And that's an area where I'm like, well, maybe they're not actually talking to each other in this case. But no, it'll be interesting to see what Trump tweets. I don't know that the Pope himself will tweet about the meeting.
But
Trump, like, I'm sure will.
Trump might tweet during the meeting.
He could.
He might whip out the iPhone or whatever the heck he uses.
Yeah.
And as we said at the top of the hour, our own Jerry O'Connell, our Vatican correspondent, will be there and will presumably be tweeting himself.
He'll be very busy this weekend as well on his way to Fatima to cover the canonization and the Mass and all the events in Fatima this weekend.
That's a big story, isn't it?
That's a big story, yeah. They expect 1 million people to be on hand for that Mass, for that celebration. So we'll be having updates throughout the weekend, Friday and Saturday, as that proceeds.
Mm. And, of course, we can also catch up, if our listeners haven't already, on the coverage of the Pope's trip to Egypt, which was Jerry O'Connell also accompanied him on.
A historic visit to Egypt.
Right. Big breakthrough. We should also mention that the reason why Michael Laughlin is such an expert on tweets and such a follower of tweets is because he's written a book about the Pope's tweets called The Tweetable Pope, A Spiritual Revolution in 140 Characters. And it's a really terrific book, and people should check it out.
Mike, as a professional journalist, did you ever think you'd be saying the word tweet quite so much at this point in your career?
I was really resistant to Twitter when I first started working in journalism.
Resistance is futile.
It's like pretty big among journalists. Like
it is.
It's actually probably bigger among journalists. Probably have a disproportionate sense of its importance in some
way. We do.
And that's a critique of it. And I can't imagine doing my job without it
now. No, right. And it's interesting. You've mentioned that the Pope actually does actually approve his tweets. So when we're talking about it, it's not just this theoretical sense of like Pope tweets.
Right.
But really it's some intern
signs off on a piece of paper on each one, so he knows what's going out there.
The high-tech approval process at the Vatican.
Right, and when he's not at the Vatican, they send him a telegram with the tweet.
In Latin, which he then reads.
They first composed on a Gutenberg press. And then
exactly. So, Mike O'Loughlin, thanks so much for being with us. Our listeners, you can continue to check out his work at americamagazine.org, all of his reporting, and be sure to check out his book, The Tweetable Pope, A Spiritual Revolution in 140 Characters. And of course, you can follow all of the news and analysis that we have talked about today on the program at americamagazine.org. And you can, I think I have to get this in one more time, you can follow us on Twitter. And on Facebook.
At American Mag.
Exactly. And you have a Twitter handle, don't you, Carrie?
I do, at Carrie_Weber.
I'm Clark at America, or as some say, Clark Eat America.
Yes.
Didn't see
and
that.
At Mike O'Loughlin.
And I'm at America Editor. So do check us out on Twitter and at AmericanMagazine.org. And of course, to subscribe to America, call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.